pretend, is what he said. Doing that, acting by design, is what we all should be doing. It's where we all belong. All of us? Designers? Oh, Dad. The song is just a given. It's how you cover it that matters. Well, let's hold on to that thought for just a minute. It's kind of like this wheelchair I'm in, right? The original tune, it's a little scary. Ooh, what happened to that dude? He can't walk. Anybody know the story? Anybody? I don't like to talk about this very much, but I'll tell you guys the story today. All right, exactly 36 years ago, this week, that's right, I was in a poorly designed automobile that had a poorly designed guardrail on a poorly designed road in Pennsylvania and plummeted down a 200-foot embankment and killed two people in the car. But ever since then, the wheelchair has been a given in my life. My life at the mercy of good design and bad design. Think about it now. In design terms, a wheelchair is a very difficult object. It mostly projects tragedy and fear and misfortune, and it projects that message, that story, so strongly that it almost blots out anything else. I roll swiftly through an airport, right, and moms grab their kids out of the way and say, "Don't stare!" And the poor kid, you know, has this terrified look on his face. God knows what they think. And for decades, you know, I'm going, why does this happen? What can I do about it? How can I change this? I mean, there must be something. You know, so I would roll, but I'd make no eye contact, you know, just kind of frown, right? Or I'd dress up really, really sharply or something. Or I'd make eye contact with everyone. You know, that was really creepy. That didn't work at all, you know. You know, anything I tried, you know, I wouldn't shower for a week. Nothing worked. Nothing whatsoever worked. Until a few years ago, my six-year-old daughters were looking at this wheelchair catalog that I had, and they said, "Oh, Dad, look, you got to get these flashy wheels. You got to get them." And I said, "Oh, girls, Dad is a very important journalist. That just wouldn't do at all." And of course, they immediately concluded, "Oh, what a bummer, Dad. Journalists aren't allowed to have flashy wheels. I mean, how important could you be then?" They said. I went, "Wait a minute. All right, right. I'll get the wheels." Purely out of protest, I got the flashy wheels, and I installed them. And check this out. Could I have my special light cue, please? Look at that. Now, Look at this. So what you are looking at here has completely changed my life. I mean, totally changed my life. Instead of blank stares and awkwardness, now it is pointing and smiling. People going, "Awesome wheels, dude, those are awesome. I mean, I want some of those wheels." Little kids say, "Can I have a ride?" And of course, there's the occasional person, usually a middle-aged male, who will say, "Oh, those wheels are great. I guess they're for safety, right?" No, they're not for safety. No. What's the difference here? The wheelchair with no lights and the wheelchair with lights. The difference is intent. That's right. I'm no longer a victim. I chose to change this situation. I'm the commander of the starship wheelchair with the phaser wheels in the front, right? Intent changes the picture completely. I choose to enhance this rolling experience with a simple design element. Acting with intent, it conveys authorship. It suggests that someone is driving. It's reassuring. People are drawn to it. Someone making the experience their own, covering the tragic tune with something different, something radically different. People respond to that. Now, it seems simple, but actually, I think in our society and culture in general, we have a huge problem with intent. Now, go with me here. Look at this guy. You know who this is? It's Anders Breivik. Now, if he intended to kill in Oslo, Norway last year, dozens and dozens of young people. If he intended to do that, he's a vicious criminal. we punish him. Life in prison, death penalty in the United States, not so much in Norway. But if he instead acted out of a delusional fantasy, if he was motivated by some random mental illness, he's in a completely different category. We may put him away for life, but we watch him clinically. It's a completely different domain. As an intentional murderer, Anders Breivik is merely evil. But as a dysfunctional murderous psychotic, he's something much more complicated. He's the breath of some primitive, ancient chaos. He's the random state of nature we emerged from. He's something very, very different. It's as though intent is an essential component for humanity. It's what we're supposed to do somehow. We're supposed to act with intent. We're supposed to do things by design. Intent is a marker for civilization. Now here's an example closer to home. My family is all about intent. You can probably tell there, two sets of twins, the result of IVF technology, in vitro fertilization technology, due to some physical limitations I won't go into. Anyway, in vitro technology, IVF, is about as intentional as agriculture. Let me tell you, some of you may have the experience. In fact, the whole technology of sperm extraction for spinal cord injured males was invented by a veterinarian. I met the dude. He's a great guy. He carried this big leather bag full of sperm probes for all of the animals that he'd worked with, all the different animals, probes he designed. And in fact, he was really, really proud of these probes. He would say, "You're right between horse and squirrel, John." But anyway, so when my wife and I decided to upgrade our early middle age, we had four kids after all, with a little different technology that I won't explain in too much detail here, my urologist assured me I had nothing whatsoever to worry about. No need for birth control, doc. Are you sure about that? John, I looked at your chart. From your sperm tests, we can confidently say that you are basically a form of birth control. What a liberating thought. Yes. And after a couple of very liberating weekends, my wife and I, utilizing some cutting-edge erectile technology that is certainly worthy of a TED talk someday, but I won't get into it now, we noticed some familiar, if unexpected, symptoms. I wasn't exactly a form of birth control. Look at that font there. My wife was so pissed. I mean, did a designer come up with that? No, I don't think a designer did come up with that. In fact, maybe that's the problem. And so, little Ajax was born. He's like our other children, but the experience is completely different. It's something like my accident, right? He came out of nowhere. But we all had to change, but not just react to the given. We bend to this new experience with intent. We're five now. Five. Facing the given with intent. Doing things by design. Hey, the name Ajax can't get much more intentional than that, right? We're really hoping he thanks us for that later on. But I never became a designer. No. Never tempted. Never even close. I did love some great designs as I was growing up. The HP 35S calculator, God, I love that thing. Oh, God, I wish I had one. Man, I love that thing. I could afford that. Other designs I really couldn't afford, like the 1974 911 Targa. In school, I studied nothing close to design or engineering. I studied useless things like the classics. But there were some lessons even there. This guy, Plato, turns out he's a designer. He designed a state. In the Republic, a design never implemented. Listen to one of the design features of Plato's government 4.0. The state in which the rulers are most reluctant to govern is always the best and most quietly governed, and the state in which they are most eager, the worst. Well, got that wrong, didn't we? But look at that statement. It's all about intent. That's what I love about it. But consider what Plato is doing here. What is he doing? It's a grand idea of design, a huge idea of design, common to all of the voices of religion and philosophy that emerged in the classical period. What was going on then? They were trying to answer the question of what would human beings do now that they were no longer simply trying to survive. As the human race emerged from a prehistoric chaos, a confrontation with random, brutal nature, they suddenly had a moment to think, and there was a lot to think about. All of a sudden, human existence needed an intent. Human life needed a reason. Reality itself needed a designer. The given was replaced by various aspects of intent, by various designs, by various gods. Gods we're still fighting about. Oh, yeah. Today, we don't confront the chaos of nature. Today, it is the chaos of humanity's impact on the earth itself that we confront. This young discipline called design, I think, is in fact the emerging ethos, formulating and then answering a very new question. What shall we do now in the face of the chaos that we have created? What shall we do? How shall we inscribe intent on all the objects we create, on all the circumstances we create, on all the places we change, the consequences of a planet with 7 billion people and counting? That's the tune we're all covering today, all of us. And we can't just imitate the past, no. That won't do. That won't do at all. Here's my favorite design moment. In the city of Kinshasa in Zaire in the 1990s, I was working for ABC News and I was reporting on the fall of Mobutu Sese Seko, the dictator, the brutal dictator in Zaire, who raped and pillaged that country. There was rioting in the middle of Kinshasa. The place was falling apart. It was a horrible, horrible place. And I needed to go and explore the center of Kinshasa to report on the rioting and the looting. People were carrying off vehicles, carrying off pieces of buildings. Soldiers were in the streets shooting at looters and hurting some in mass arrests. In the middle of this chaos, I'm rolling around in a wheelchair, and I was completely invisible. Completely. I was in a wheelchair. Didn't look like a looter. I was in a wheelchair. Didn't look like a journalist, particularly, at least from their perspective. And I didn't look like a soldier, that's for sure. I was part of this sort of background noise of the misery of Zaire, completely invisible. And all of a sudden, from around a corner, comes this young man paralyzed just like me, in this metal and wood and leather pedal three-wheel tricycle wheelchair device, and he pedals up to me as fast as he can. He goes, "Hey, mister! Mister!" And I looked at him. He didn't know any other English than that, but we didn't need English. No, 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 no. We sat there and compared wheels and tires and spokes and tubes. And I looked at his wacky pedal mechanism. He was full of pride over his design. I wish I could show you that contraption. His smile, our glow, as we talked a universal language of design. Invisible to the chaos around us, his machine, homemade, bolted, rusty, comical. "My machine, American-made, confident, sleek." He was particularly proud of the comfortable seat, really comfortable seat he had made in his chariot and its beautiful fabric fringe around the edge. Oh, I wish I'd had those sparkly wheels back then to have shown him. Man, he would have loved those. Oh, yeah, he would have understood those. A chariot of pure intent, think about it, in a city out of control. Design blew it all away for a moment. We spoke for a few minutes, and then each of us vanished back into the chaos. He went back to the streets of Kinshasa. I went to my hotel, and I think of him now. And I pose this question. An object imbued with intent, it has power, it's treasure, we're drawn to it. An object devoid of intent, it's random, it's imitative, it repels us, it's like a piece of junk mail to be thrown away. This is what we must demand of our lives, of our objects, of our things, of our circumstances, living with intent. And I have to say that on that score, I have a very unfair advantage over all of you. And I want to explain it to you now because this is a very special day. 36 years ago, at nearly this moment, a 19-year-old boy awoke from a coma to ask a nurse a question, but the nurse was already there with an answer. "You've had a terrible accident, young man. You've broken your back. You'll never walk again." I said, "I know all that. What day is it?" You see, I knew that the car had gone over the guardrail on the 28th of February, and I knew that 1976 was a leap year. "Nurse, is this the 28th or the 29th? And she looked at me and said, "It's March 1st. And I went, "Oh my God, I've got some catching up to do." And from that moment, I knew the given was that accident. I had no option but to make up this new life without walking. Intent, a life with intent, lived by design, covering the original with something better. It's something for all of us to do or find a way to do in these times. To get back to this, to get back to design. And as my daddy suggested a long time ago, make the song your own, John. Show everybody what you intend. Daddy, this one's for you. Jojo was a man who thought he was a loner, but he was another man. Jojo left his home in Tucson, Arizona, to attend the California Bash. Get back, get back, get back to where you once belonged. Get back, get back, get back to where you once belong.
So my freshman year of college, I signed up for an internship in the housing unit at Greater Boston Legal Services. Showed up the first day ready to make coffee and photocopies, but was paired with this righteous, deeply inspired attorney named Jeff Purcell, who thrust me onto the front lines from the very first day. And over the course of 9 months, I had the chance to have dozens of conversations with low-income families in Boston, who would come in presenting with housing issues, but always had an underlying health issue. So I had a client who came in about to be evicted because he hasn't paid his rent. But he hasn't paid his rent, of course, because he's paying for his HIV medication and just can't afford both. We had moms who would come in, daughter has asthma, wakes up covered in cockroaches every morning. And one of our litigation strategies was actually to send me into the home of these clients with these large glass bottles, and I would collect the cockroaches, hot glue gun them to this poster board that we bring to court for our cases. And we always won because the judges were just so grossed out. Far more effective, I have to say, than anything I later learned in law school. But over the course of these 9 months, I grew frustrated with feeling like we were intervening too far downstream in the lives of our clients, that by the time they came to us, they were already in crisis. And at the end of my freshman year of college, I read an article about the work that Dr. Barry Zuckerman was doing as chair of pediatrics at Boston Medical Center, and his first hire was a legal services attorney to represent the patients. So I called Barry, and with his blessing, in October 1995, walked into the waiting room of the pediatrics clinic at Boston Medical Center. I'll never forget, the TVs played this endless reel of cartoons, and the exhaustion of mothers who had taken 2, 3, sometimes 4 buses to bring their child to the doctor was just palpable. The doctors, it seemed, never really had enough time for all the patients, try as they might, and over the course of 6 months, I would corner them in the hallway and ask them a sort of naive but fundamental question. If you had unlimited resources, what's the one thing you would give your patients? And I heard the same story again and again, a story we've heard hundreds of times since then. They said, every day we have patients that come into the clinic, child has an ear infection, I prescribe antibiotics, but the real issue is there's no food at home. The real issue is that child is living with 12 other people in a 2-bedroom apartment, and I don't even ask about those issues because there's nothing I can do. I have 13 minutes with each patient. Patients are piling up in the clinic waiting room. I have no idea where the nearest food pantry is, and I don't even have any help. In that clinic, even today, there are 2 social workers for 24,000 pediatric patients, which is better than a lot of the clinics out there. So HealthLeads was born of these conversations, a simple model where doctors and nurses can prescribe nutritious food, heat in the winter, and other basic resources for their patients, the same way they prescribe medication. Patients then take their prescriptions to our desk in the clinic waiting room, where we have a core of well-trained college student advocates who work side by side with these families to connect them out to the existing landscape of community resources. So we began with a card table in the clinic waiting room, totally lemonade stand style. But today we have 1,000 college student advocates who are working to connect nearly 9,000 patients and their families with the resources that they need to be healthy. So 18 months ago, I got this email that changed my life. And the email was from Dr. Jack Geiger, who had written to congratulate me on HealthLeads and to share, as he said, a bit of historical context. In 1965, Dr. Geiger founded one of the first 2 community health centers in this country in a brutally poor area in the Mississippi Delta. And so many of his patients came in presenting with malnutrition that he began prescribing food for them. And they would take these prescriptions to the local supermarket, which would fill them and then charge the pharmacy budget of the clinic. And when the Office of Economic Opportunity in Washington, D.C., which was funding Geiger's clinic, found out about this, they were furious. And they sent this bureaucrat down to tell Geiger that he was expected to use their dollars for medical care. To which Geiger famously and logically responded, "Last time I checked my textbooks, the specific therapy for malnutrition was food." So, when I got this email from Dr. Geiger, I knew I was supposed to be proud to be part of this history. But the truth is, I was devastated. Here we are, 45 years after Geiger has prescribed food for his patients, and I have doctors telling me, on those issues, we practice a don't ask, don't tell policy. 45 years after Geiger, HealthLeads has to reinvent the prescription for basic resources. So I have spent hours upon hours trying to make sense of this weird Groundhog Day. How is it that if for decades we had a pretty straightforward tool for keeping patients, and especially low-income patients, healthy, that we didn't use it? If we know what it takes to have a healthcare system rather than a sick care system, why don't we just do it? These questions, in my mind, are not hard because the answers are complicated. They are hard because they require that we be honest with ourselves. My belief is that it's almost too painful to articulate our aspirations for our healthcare system or even admit that we have any at all, because if we did, they would be so removed from our current reality. But that doesn't change my belief that all of us, deep inside, here in this room and across this country, share a similar set of desires. That if we are honest with ourselves and listen quietly, that we all harbor one fiercely held aspiration for our healthcare, that it keep us healthy. This aspiration that our healthcare keep us healthy is an enormously powerful one. And You know, the way I think about this is that healthcare is like any other system. It's just a set of choices that people make. What if we decided to make a different set of choices? What if we decided to take all the parts of healthcare that have drifted away from us and stand firm and say, no, these things are ours. They will be used for our purposes. They will be used to realize our aspiration. What if everything we needed to realize our aspiration for healthcare was right there in front of us, just waiting to be claimed? So that's where Health Leads began. We started with the prescription pad, a very ordinary piece of paper, and we asked not what do patients need to get healthy, antibiotics, an inhaler, medication, but what do patients need to be healthy, to not get sick in the first place? And we chose to use the prescription for that purpose. So just a few miles from here at Children's National Medical Center, when patients come into the doctor's office, they're asked a few questions. They're asked, are you running out of food at the end of the month? Do you have safe housing? And when the doctor begins the visit, she knows height, weight, is there food at home? Is the family living in a shelter? And that not only leads to a better set of clinical choices, but the doctor can also prescribe those resources for the patient using Health Leads like any other subspecialty referral. The problem is, once you get a taste of what it's like to realize your aspiration for healthcare, you want more. So we thought, okay, if we can get individual doctors to prescribe these basic resources for their patients, could we get an entire healthcare system to shift its presumption? And we gave it a shot. So now at Harlem Hospital Center, when patients come in with an elevated body mass index, the electronic medical record automatically generates a prescription for Health Leads. And our volunteers can then work with them to connect patients to healthy food and exercise programs in their communities. We've created a presumption that if you're a patient at that hospital with an elevated BMI, the four walls of the doctor's office probably aren't going to give you everything you need to be healthy. You need more. So on the one hand, this is just a basic recoding of the electronic medical record. And on the other hand, it's a radical transformation of the electronic medical record from a static repository of diagnostic information to a health promotion tool. In the private sector, when you squeeze that kind of additional value out of a fixed cost investment, it's called a billion-dollar company. But in my world, it's called reduced obesity and diabetes. It's called health care, a system where doctors can prescribe solutions to improve health, not just manage disease. Same thing in the clinic waiting room. So every day in this country, 3 million patients pass through about 150,000 clinic waiting rooms in this country. And what do they do when they're there? They sit, they watch the goldfish in the fish tank, they read extremely old copies of Good Housekeeping magazine, but mostly we all just sit there forever waiting. How did we get here where we devote hundreds of acres and thousands of hours to waiting? What if we had a waiting room where you don't just sit when you're sick, but where you go to get healthy? If airports can become shopping malls and McDonald's can become playgrounds, surely we can reinvent the clinic waiting room. And that's what Health Leads has tried to do, to reclaim that real estate and that time and to use it as a gateway to connect patients to the resources they need to be healthy. So it's a brutal winter in the Northeast, your kid has asthma, your heat just got turned off, and of course you're in the waiting room of the ER because the cold air triggered your child's asthma. But what if instead of waiting for hours anxiously, the waiting room became the place where Health Leads turned your heat back on? And of course all of this requires a broader workforce. But if we're creative, we already have that too. We know that our doctors and nurses and even social workers aren't enough, that the ticking minutes of healthcare are too constraining. Health just takes more time. It requires a non-clinical army of community health workers and case managers and many others. What if a small part of that next healthcare workforce were the 11 million college students in this country, unencumbered by clinical responsibilities, unwilling to take no from an answer from those bureaucracies that tend to crush patients, and with an unparalleled ability for information retrieval honed through years of using Google? Now, lest you think it improbable that a college volunteer can make this kind of commitment, I have two words for you: March Madness. The average NCAA Division I men's basketball player dedicates 39 hours a week to his sport. Now, we may think that's good or bad, but either case, it's real. And HealthLeads is based on the presumption that for too long, we have asked too little of our college students when it comes to real impact in vulnerable communities. College sports teams say, we're going to take dozens of hours at some field across campus at some ungodly hour of the morning, and we're going to measure your performance and your team's performance, and if you don't measure up or you don't show up, we're going to cut you off the team. But we'll make huge investments in your training and development, and we'll give you an extraordinary community of peers. And people line up out the door just for the chance to be part of it. So our feeling is, if it's good enough for the rugby team, it's good enough for health and poverty. HealthLeads, too, recruits competitively, trains intensively, coaches professionally, demands significant time, builds a cohesive team, and measures results. A kind of Teach for America for healthcare. Now, in the top 10 cities in the U.S. with the largest number of Medicaid patients, each of those has at least 20,000 college students. New York alone has 500,000 college students. And this isn't just a sort of short-term workforce to connect patients to basic resources. It's a next-generation healthcare leadership pipeline who have spent 2, 3, 4 years in the clinic waiting room talking to patients about their most basic health needs. And they leave with the conviction, the ability, and the efficacy to realize our most basic aspirations for healthcare. And the thing is, there's thousands of these folks already out there. So, Mia Lozada is chief resident of internal medicine at UCSF Medical Center, but for 3 years as an undergraduate, she was a HealthLeads volunteer in the clinic waiting room at Boston Medical Center. Mia says, when my classmates write a prescription, they think their work is done. When I write a prescription, I think, can the family read the prescription? Do they have transportation to the pharmacy? Do they have food to take with the prescription? Do they have insurance to fill the prescription? Those are the questions I learned at HealthLeads, not in medical school. Now, none of these solutions, the prescription pad, the electronic medical record, the waiting room, the army of college students, are perfect. But they are ours for the taking, simple examples of the vast, underutilized healthcare resources that if we reclaimed and redeployed, could realize our most basic aspiration of healthcare. So I had been at Legal Services for about 9 months when this idea of HealthLeads started percolating in my mind, and I knew I had to tell Jeff Purcell, that my attorney, that I needed to leave, and I was so nervous because I thought he was going to be disappointed in me for abandoning our clients for some crazy idea. And I sat down with him and I said, Jeff, I have this idea that we could mobilize college students to address patients' most basic health needs. And I'll be honest, all I wanted was for him to not be angry at me. But he said this, Rebecca, when you have a vision, you have an obligation to realize that vision. You must pursue that vision. And I have to say, I was like, whoa, that's a lot of pressure. I just wanted a blessing. I didn't want some kind of mandate. But the truth is, I've spent every waking minute nearly since then chasing that vision. I believe that we all have a vision for healthcare in this country. I believe that at the end of the day, when we measure our healthcare, it will not be by the diseases cured, but by the diseases prevented. It will not be by the excellence of our technologies or the sophistication of our specialists, but by how rarely we needed them. And most of all, I believe that when we measure healthcare, it will be not by what the system was, but by what we chose it to be. Thank you. Thank you.
Remembering Ray, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. Ray Bradbury threaded in and out of my life for many, many years. It began with reading his short stories when I was a kid. Then I began running into Ray, but the best may have come when I began sharing him with his fans through this show and other media. Today, we'll look back through the eyes of others who loved him, and we'll hear a bit of the 83rd birthday party the Planetary Society threw for Ray back in 2003. We'll begin after we hear from Emily Lakdawalla and Bill Nye. Emily, Skype is acting strangely, so I've got you on, well, it's still a telephone connection via Skype. Tell us what's going on. I mean, first of all, something that may not be covered at least by yourself in the blog a lot, but although you have at least one entry from Jay Pasikoff, was the Venus transit.
This event, you know, I'm sad that I haven't had time to write everything up, but I took my daughters up to Griffith Observatory to watch the event. There were a huge number of astronomers out there with telescopes. I learned, actually, that probably half of them were observatory staff with their own telescopes. And one of them was a huge fan of the blog, and so he was delighted to see me as I was to see him. He had a really nice setup with a projection of the image of the sun through the telescope onto a fairly large screen, so it was pretty easy. A large crowd of us gathered around to watch first contact, and he counted down as the as Venus got close to the sun, and then we didn't see anything at first, but then somebody finally spotted where the dot was as it began to cross the disk of the sun, and that was pretty cool. I enjoyed blowing people's minds by telling them about how Venus, the sun was three times farther away from us than Venus was, so that dot of that planet, which is the same size as Earth, roughly, was actually three times bigger than it should have been with respect to the sun in terms of its exact size.
You've made me even sorrier that I ended up sick that day because I was headed up there with my telescope and changed my mind because it just didn't make sense. But I had a great time watching from my driveway.
I do have to say it was one of those absolutely spectacular days that makes you so happy you live in Southern California. It was stunningly blue sky, a nice fresh breeze from the sea in the upper 70s. It was great.
Sorry, rest of the world. We just have to rub it in now and then. Tell us briefly about your conversation that people can watch with Dan Derda.
Yeah, well, I met up with Dan Derda at Space Fest last week. And, you know, he is both an asteroid researcher and a space artist. And so we had a wide-ranging conversation about asteroids and near-Earth object impact threat mitigation and suborbital research flights, and then on to space art. And he actually talked to me a little bit about all of the different digital computer tools that he uses to create his space art. And it's really quite fascinating. It was a really fun conversation that I hope to repeat.
And that conversation, you can get to it from the Planetary Society blog. It's an entry from Emily on the 7th of June, 2012. Just go to planetary.org and click on Emily's blog. Thanks, Emily. I hope we have Skype working again next week.
Thank you, Matt. Look forward to it.
She is the Science and Technology Coordinator for the Planetary Society and a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine, and also, I think, every other week, the host of the Google Plus Science Hour, this time with Dan Derda. Coming up next is Bill Nye. Bill, this is quite a trip you're on.
I was in Montreal earlier this week, and I received the Ralph Coates Rowe Medal for the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. And it turns out there's like this informal conspiracy of old professors, colleagues, space people, who apparently have been interviewed by the American Society of Mechanical Engineers looking for a worthy candidate, and I've been picked. It was quite a thing, Matt. It was quite a thing for me. So these guys, no one will tell me, did you contribute? No, no, I don't know anything about it. They're obviously... It's like getting an Emmy for mechanical engineering. Anyway, along that line, this week I'll be at the SOFIN panel at the International Space University Conference in Melbourne, Florida, you know, just south of Cape Canaveral, where Florida Institute of Technology is. And I'm going to talk about some of the same stuff that I talked about the mechanical engineers, and that is there's a control algorithm that's ideal for spacecraft that I think people should embrace, and it's based on one of my old professor's ideas. That's all. Wow, that was a long way around, wasn't it? It's very exciting. It'll be Scott Hubbard, who's on the board of the Planetary Society, Maria Zuber, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Pete Warden, the guy who runs NASA Ames now. Hey, you know, Matt, you know what I ought to do? I should ask everybody in the audience if they have a ride, a rocket, going to medium Earth orbit.
Hmm.
That way we can get light sail flying.
Actually, you can ask this audience, too.
That's what I'll do. Yeah.
Well, I hope that somebody out there has a rocket with a space for a few extra kilograms on it, and we have a light sail that's looking for that ride. Well, good luck. I hope somebody answers us in the affirmative.
Yeah, we'll see. Thanks, Matt.
Bill Nye is the CEO of the Planetary Society. He's on the road. He's coming back middle of this week, so perhaps we'll be talking to him at home next time around here on Planetary Radio. Next up, a Ray Bradbury retrospective. We wanted to make Ray Bradbury's 83rd birthday very special. It came in August of 2003, just as Earth was passing closer to Mars than it would for many, many years. That opportunity was too good to pass up. Not all of Ray's admirers could make it to Pasadena for the celebration, but that didn't stop them from sending their greetings.
Happy birthday, Ray. This is Chris McKay up at NASA Ames. I've always been a big fan of your writing, been a big fan of Mars. I'm also happy to see, of course, that the planet is coming in this month to celebrate your birthday as well. Maybe someday we'll have humans on Mars, and they'll look back and be able to wave to us on these times when Mars comes close to Earth. Anyway, happy birthday. Thoughts of Mars and water and life and humans going there.
Filmmaker Peter Hyams was a special guest at Ray Bradbury's 2003 birthday party. He was putting the finishing touches on A Sound of Thunder, based on one of Ray's stories. Hyams brought with him messages from many of Ray's other fans.
I would first like to thank the Planetary Society, not only for arranging this tribute to our national treasure, but also for making the whole notion of space exploration so exciting and so accessible to so many people. I would like to read a few of these greetings. They're from people you might have heard of. Warmest birthday wishes and light speed to a true American icon, a visionary, and a genius. You are the rarest of gems, Ray, and it has been one of my great privileges to know you, Buzz Aldrin. Isn't it fitting that Mars should be so close to Earth for your 83rd birthday? You've been an inspiration to us all. Happy birthday, George Lucas. Some time ago, I had the good fortune to be seated next to Ray Bradbury on a flight from Los Angeles to Texas. I have never flown so high since or been so lucky since. What a ride. You are a joy and a genius. You are my kind of guy, and I love you, Angie Dickinson. Now, on a less celestial note, whatever people see or find in any planet, they will never find or see a better pair of legs than Angie Dickinson. You showed us that Mars is not only a place for science, but a place of wonder and of dreams that would call to our hearts even after we Earthlings become the Martians. Happy birthday, Ray. Michael and Denise Okuda from Star Trek. Even in this time of everyday wonders, I still dream of the silver rockets of my youth, kept eternally alive in the imagination by your wondrous prose. Thank you for opening that window in my mind. My best wishes to you for a happy birthday and the continued birth of your glorious dreams, James Cameron. Fahrenheit 451 is a temperature which will burn flesh. However, it's not nearly as hot as its author. Ray, what did you do on this plane ride? You have engulfed us with oh so many other classics, but Ray, you're not just an author, you are an institution. I love Bradbury the man, the artist, the visionary sand as a fledgling sci-fi author. I am so very proud to have lived in your shadow, Nichelle Nichols. Happy birthday to our dear good friend Ray, a true creative genius, love, Charlton and Lydia Heston. The many writers you've inspired are indeed your children. And though the first human to land on Mars might not be named Nathaniel York, that person will be your child too. Happy birthday, Judy and Gar Reeve Stevens. You have always been a ray of light and a hope in a world often absent of imagination. You challenge our linear thinking, and for those of us who have lived out of the box, what first got us there can often be traced to your long and short works of science fiction and fantasy. Happy birthday, love, Steven Spielberg. Lastly is mine, which was, Ray, you are the master, you are the source, I have had no greater honor or privilege than spending time with you and bringing your breathtaking imagination to the screen. Keep eating steak and drinking wine for lunch. It seems to work. Happy birthday.
Director Peter Hyams. Author Kim Stanley Robinson was another guest at that 2003 birthday party for Ray Bradbury.
By coincidence, I suppose, I was born in the same town that he was, Waukegan, Illinois. It's always been an important fact to me as an American science fiction writer. I've always felt a strong affinity for his work. And so I've made attempts to meet him before, but in fact, I mean, I've seen him speak before. He's been wonderful, but I've never had the chance to actually say hello. And recently wrote an introduction to the Martian Chronicles and realized again what a wonderful book that was. So between Waukegan and Southern California and Mars, I feel like he's some kind of a spiritual godfather, and I want to meet him. So this is my chance.
What was your first Bradbury experience?
I think it was the reading of a short story about Ernest Hemingway, a beautiful, interesting, and disturbing story in which Hemingway was wishing that he had actually been killed in the plane crash that he almost died in Africa in 56 so that he wouldn't become suicidal in 61. An odd entry to Bradbury compared to some, but it just was how I first stumbled across him as a high school student. And then I started reading his short stories, and like most American science fiction writers, I've read a great deal of his work.
You heard some tributes from some of your colleagues tonight, at least recorded ones, and there are others that are on the big card that was made for Ray. And yet, some people say, well, yeah, he writes science fiction, but he also does more than that. And you're kind of in that boat, too, I would say, with Years of Rice and Salt.
Well, I think the important thing is that he does do more than that and has always been accepted as a major figure in American literature and then has gone out and been the ambassador to the world for American science fiction. He's never renounced it. He's always embraced it. He's always talked about its importance. There have a number of writers, not of his stature, who, having been accepted by the larger literary world, have then renounced science fiction, and he's never been one of those. So there's a natural affection amongst the science fiction writers that have come after him for his advocacy of our genre, the way that he always has stood up for us. You got to love him for that. I love him for that.
You got to say hi to him just a moment ago?
Yes, I did. It was great. It's clear that he did indeed read my little introduction to the Martian Chronicles so that he knew who I was. I wasn't really expecting that he had read my work. But since this was directly relevant, it was something so that he knew who I was. And then it was fun to be able to tell him about my birthplace being the same as his, because I'm sure it brought another connection in to talk about, because I actually came from the next town to the north, which was Zion, Illinois, a kind of religious utopia. And he knew all about that, and it was wonderful, actually, to hear his fairly detailed knowledge of a town that nobody else in the world knows about. So it's nice.
Author Kim Stanley Robinson at the Planetary Society's birthday party for Ray Bradbury back in 2003. Still to come are more tributes and the words of Bradbury himself. This is Planetary Radio.
I'm Robert Picardo. I traveled across the galaxy as the Doctor in Star Trek Voyager. Then I joined the Planetary Society to become part of the real adventure of space exploration. The Society fights for missions that unveil the secrets of the solar system. It searches for other intelligences in the universe, and it built the first solar sail. It also shares the wonder through this radio show, its website, and other exciting projects that reach around the globe. I'm proud to be part of this greatest of all voyages, and I hope you'll consider joining us.
You can learn more about the Planetary Society at our website, planetary.org/radio, or by calling 1-800-9-WORLDS. Planetary Radio listeners who aren't yet members can join and receive a Planetary Radio t-shirt. Our nearly 100,000 members receive the internationally acclaimed Planetary Report magazine. That's planetary.org/radio. The Planetary Society, exploring new worlds.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. We are celebrating the life and work of Ray Bradbury through the wishes sent to him by friends and admirers, celebrating Ray's 83rd birthday in August of 2003. Here's another great author.
Ray, it's your fellow graduate from L.A. High School, Los Angeles High School, David Brin, along with Stephen Barnes, also from L.A. High, wishing our fellow alumnus all the best wishes on his wonderful, wonderful birthday. You're the guy who made this century happen, Ray. You're the guy who inspired us. I'm known as a bit of an optimist. In fact, I'm known as a preacher of optimism in an age of cynicism. And you just make me look like a dour cynic. I have never seen a stem-winding speech like the one you always give about what a treason it is to this wonderful era and to our grandchildren to give up or to think that these are bad times. You're the guy who's held forth that these are times worth defending and that the future is worthwhile. And God bless you, and you keep at it.
Science fiction author David Brin. David will join us to talk about his new book, Existence, in a few weeks. Let's listen to Ray Bradbury now, but not until we finish singing to him on the occasion of his 83rd birthday in August of 2003.
Oh, this is great. You know, when I think back when I was in high school and I read my first Edgar Rice Burroughs books, The Warlord of Mars and Thuvia of Mars and all the other Martian books of Edgar Rice Burroughs, and I saw the drawings of Schiaparelli and the photographs from Lowell Observatory. And I wrote my first story, which was a sequel to the Warlords of Mars by Burroughs. So you see before you someone who started out for Mars a long time ago. So it's a very special evening. And I saw a French magazine today. They sent me an article, and the headline over my face was, "I never came back from Mars." I just never came back. Because Edgar Rice Burroughs taught me how to go out on the lawns of summer and hold my hands up and say, "Mars, take me home." And Mars took me home. And I've been there forever. So this evening is a wonderful celebration to me. My good friend Sam Weller is here tonight, and he's doing a book about my life. And he asked me the other day how I'd like to be remembered in connection with Mars, because a lot's going to happen the next few years. I'd like to quote first, I've written a new book of essays which will come out next year, and the title of which is Remembering the Future, Predicting the Past. Remembering the Future, Predicting the Past. Also, Too Soon from the Cave, Too Far from the Stars. We're the in-between generation. We're in between the cave and the stars where we're going to live in the next 10,000 years. So we got a lot to forgive ourselves for. Huh? We've done a lot of things wrong, but we've done a lot of things right. When I was a child, I thought maybe we'd land on the moon when I was an old man. Well, it didn't work that way. I was in my 40s. And what a night that was. And what we're going to be doing in the next few years with our Martian landers and our final landing on Mars with real people to call back to us across space is going to exhilarate all of mankind. What we need now is a substitute for war. We're engaged in a dozen wars all over the world right now in various countries. And there has to be some way of elevating our spirit and saying that mankind is special and wonderful, and space travel is the way we do it. And all the peoples of the world, in a real effort, will do this. And we'll be going to Mars with all of the people, not just a few, in the next 10, 20, 30 years. I wish I could stick around to be part of it. But the thing I dream is this, that some night, 100 nights, 100 years from now, there will be a boy on Mars reading late at night with a flashlight under the covers, huh? And he'll look out at the Martian landscape, which will be bleak, and rocky and red and not very romantic. But when he turns out the light and lies with a copy of my book, I hope, The Martian Chronicles, the Martian winds outside will stir, and the ghosts that are in my book will rouse up, and my creatures, even though they never lived, will be on Mars. And that's the dream I have, and that's the reason I'm here tonight. Thank you very much.
Ray Bradbury at his Planetary Society birthday party in 2003. We've collected all of Ray's appearances on this show. You'll find links and some of my personal memories in my blog at planetary.org. Bruce Betts is next, but first we'll get one more birthday greeting from a fan of the great author and human being we lost earlier this month.
Hi, Mr. Bradbury. I'm Gigi Fernandez, a 16-year-old junior at St. Joseph High School in Lakewood, California. Next month, I'll be on stage with other students performing dramatized versions of four of your wonderful stories. Thank you so much for the magic you've brought into our world, and happy birthday from all of us.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts is here. He's the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society. Bonjour.
Bonjour.
Which is just a foreshadowing of our trivia question today. How are you?
I see what you're doing there. That's so clever. I'm good. But as always, you're in charge of all French pronunciation.
I'll do my best. You know, I'm not allowed to speak it at home. Which is just as well, because I really can't. You watched the transit, right?
Of course I watched the transit. I was a tweeting fiend. Yes, went to a Caltech and watched it there. And you staying home sick, watching with your telescope at home.
Oh, well, it was just as beautiful for my driveway.
No, but I'm glad you think so.
All right. What else is up?
I'm just kidding. It was just as beautiful there. It was really groovy. And for anyone who missed it or just can't wait, don't forget, Mercury Transit 2016. Be there.
Yes, and 2117, as you told us last week, for the next Venus one.
Speaking of which, let's focus on Mercury now. Low in the west, but getting a little higher over the next week or so, is Mercury shortly after sunset. You may be able to see it getting a little bit higher, and in fact, it kind of lines up with the Gemini stars, Castor and Pollux, a little later in June. And there's even a Mercury or Moon Mercury Castor and Pollux rough line, but again, very low on the horizon in the west shortly after sunset. That line would be on June 21st. Easier to see and higher up in the evening sky is Mars, which is reddish, and it is to the right of Saturn and Spica. And so they're all forming a very rough line. Mostly Mars is just over to the right. Saturn and Spica being the blue star, bright star of Virgo. And those three will be getting closer and closer as the summer goes along, making for some groovy conjunctions in several weeks. Pre-dawn, if you're up, Jupiter and Venus creeping in there over the next days and weeks, very low in the east in the pre-dawn. Jupiter is the higher one, so if you see one bright star-like object, it's probably Jupiter, but Venus will be getting up there following its fabulous transit. We move on to this week in space history. Two 45th anniversaries, not coincidentally, both launched this week. Venera 4, the Soviet Venus probe, launched this week. It ended up providing the first in-situ measurements, or measurements in another planet's atmosphere and sending them to Earth. Was designed as a lander, theoretically. Didn't make that part, but did find out that the Venus atmosphere was a lot weirder than we thought. And also more information on Venus atmosphere provided by the U.S. Mariner 5, launched this week and did a successful Venus flyby. Random space fact!
Bye, doggies!
So one thing that's always bugged me in astronomy nomenclature, because it's designed to confuse, a planetary nebula. This isn't a nebula bunch of gas, in this case ionized gas. It emits light. It's an emission nebula. It's an expanding glowing shell of ionized gas. It has nothing to do with planets. Ejected during the very late stages, red giant type stages of low to medium mass stars as they kind of belch gas outwards. It's a little bit more technical than belching, but that's the concept. Late in their life, doesn't have to do with planets, but we call it a planetary nebula because an astronomer in the late 1700s thought these objects, this cloudy object in his telescope, looked similar in appearance to Uranus. And we've been stuck with it ever since. We'll get back to who we can blame for that a little bit later in the show. Look, I foreshadowed too. All right, we go on to the trivia contest so you can get all French on us. We asked you, what is the name of the scale that is commonly used to rate the visual appearance and brightness of the moon during total lunar eclipses? What is the name of that scale, Matt?
It is, according to Randy Bottom of Brighton, Ontario, the Dangean scale, named after André-Louis Dangean, not surprisingly, because he came up with it. And it's this, as you said a couple of weeks ago, it's this five-point scale that tells you how the viewing is when you're looking at the moon.
And it's telling you about the eclipse, and because of how dark or how not dark and how red it is, it gives an idea of how much. It's actually an indication of the Earth's atmosphere as much as anything, because it gives an idea of how much light is passing through the Earth's atmosphere.
So, Randy, we're going to send you a Planetary Radio t-shirt. He came up with his own scale, the bottom scale, which is a three-point scale, cloudy, mostly cloudy, and OMG. I also liked William Stewart had this terrific alternative scale that I had never heard of, the Dangean scale, which is not to be confused, of course, with the Jambon scale, which is a measure of the pinkness of pork products.
Yeah, that's really very different.
Pigs in space. Okay.
All right. What's next trivia contest having nothing to my knowledge to do with pigs in space. Pigs in space! But now I had to say it. Who was that astronomer who in the late 1700s named Planetary Nebula Planetary Nebula, and we've been stuck with it ever since? Who was it? Go to planetary.org/radio, find out how to enter.
We'll give you until the 18th of this month, June 18 at 2 p.m. Pacific time, to get us your answer.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about dust, both in space and what I seem to be breathing in right now.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good night.
He's Bruce Betts, the Dusty Director of Projects for the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and made possible by a grant from the Kenneth T. and Eileen L. Norris Foundation and by the members of the Planetary Society. Ray, clear skies on Barsoom.